This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
On the Nolan Show today, the fallout and the summary of the astonishing, the eye-watering testimony around how our government and the civil service function during COVID, and text messages and WhatsApp message exchanges being revealed to the inquiry, and then WhatsApp messages which were deleted despite the inquiry telling the Northern Ireland Civil Service that the information should be protected. Notes around an executive meeting after Michelle O'Neill attended the funeral of Bobby Storey. Notes of that executive meeting lost. What type of country are we living in? What are the rules of engagement here between the people we trust and how they behave? Who's going to hold them to account? How do notes go missing? How do official records go missing? It's an astonishing programme today.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
It's such an important programme today for you to be involved in, because it's about the people who govern us. It's about the Northern Ireland Civil Service. It's about how people died during COVID. It's about how people were protected during COVID by our government. And the COVID inquiry began yesterday, and evidence has already emerged which would stand the hairs up on the back of your neck. And it includes our chief medical officer, Professor Sir Michael McBride, describing some executive ministers. And I should warn you that you will hear some language this morning that you may find offensive. Professor Michael McBride described some executive ministers as dysfunctional bastards in a text message, a WhatsApp message that he had sent to the then Health Minister, Robin Swan. We will read so that we're being fair, exactly what Michael McBride said. He said that may well be why in the autumn of 2020, Northern Ireland's, this is the testimony to the COVID inquiry yesterday. He said, dysfunctional bees, how will we ever get through this with an enemy within? I have a good mind to walk off and leave them to it, as no doubt do you. But then those that really matter, those whom they seem to have forgotten they represent, are really depending on us. Now, some people will wonder about the provocative language from Michael McBride. The COVID inquiry yesterday made it clear that these people were under intense pressure. The other thing about Michael McBride was we know what he said because he did as he was instructed, and the people around him did as they were instructed. And so his WhatsApp messages are available and were handed to the inquiry. You, the public, should know, and we'll set this out for you from the inquiry, that an instruction was given to the Northern Ireland Civil Service that the data, that the messages needed to be protected, that they should not be wiped, that they would be vital for this inquiry. Many of the phones were wiped anyway. How did that happen? On top of that, you should know that an executive meeting in which Michelle O'Neill was explaining to other ministers how, despite her issuing guidance to the rest of you that you should not attend family funerals, how she attended the funeral along with many of her Sinn Féin colleagues of the IRA man and her friend, Bobby Storey. The Northern Ireland Civil Service is telling you and the inquiry they have, quote, lost the notes of that executive meeting. Lost the notes. Now, should we just leave it at that? Oh, well, phones get wiped when they shouldn't. Oh, well, notes get lost. Or as the TUV leader, Jim Allister, write, when he says that after this inquiry, in 3 weeks' time, here's all the evidence, there is a very good case that the PSNI should now undertake an investigation as to whether there has been misconduct in public office. How does the civil service lose notes? How did they come to be lost? Who lost them? What are the exact circumstances at which phones get wiped when there's been an instruction not to wipe them? We will lay out lots of the testimony from that inquiry yesterday. Peter Wilcock, KC, who represents the Northern Ireland COVID Bereaved Families for Justice Group, set out some of what he has found shocking already.
The difficult and vexed question of whether to shut schools in March 2020 could be decided not on the grounds of science, not on the grounds of the admittedly difficult question of the balance of undeniably complex competing interests, but by the simple question of whether we should follow London or Dublin, or whether British scientific advice was inevitably preferable to Irish scientific advice, or vice versa. And, my lady, we say that there were many examples of political dysfunction in the political response to the pandemic. In this context, you will hear evidence of outrageous and scientifically baseless assertions by senior politicians, senior ministers, that there was a meaningful difference in transmission between nationalist and unionist areas. And we suggest that the nadir of this dysfunction came during the meetings you've heard about, the acrimonious and late-night meetings of the executive between the 9th and 12th of 2020, when the Democratic Unionist Party thought it appropriate to insist on a cross-community vote on public health measures, which affected every community equally. So they could effectively exercise a veto over the continuation of coronavirus restrictions, supported, as Ms. Dobbins has just observed, by the Northern Ireland CMO and other political parties from all communities, including the Ulster Unionist Minister of Health. And, my lady, this action created the clear impression amongst many of those that I represent, and not for the first time or exclusively by the biggest unionist party, that even with 8 months' experience of the terrible dangers of COVID, party politics mattered more to some senior politicians than following the science. And as if to demonstrate that the DUP were not alone, the following month, the Deputy First Minister seemingly refused to sign off a Four Nations joint statement in advance of Christmas 2020, in what looked to some as a fit of pique after a proposal by her party to implement travel restrictions from GB, where a new variant was in circulation, failed. Now, my lady, there is no doubt that these times were stressful for everyone involved. And that may well be why in the autumn of 2020, Northern Ireland's Chief Medical Officer, Dr. McBride, used uncharacteristically coarse language in exchanges with the Minister of Health when he wrote, and I quote, "Dysfunctional bastards. How will we ever get through this with an enemy within? I have a good mind to walk off and leave them to it, as no doubt do you. But then those that really matter, those whom they seem to have forgotten they represent, are really depending on us." Now, my lady, whilst this stress or frustration may explain the choice of language, it does not explain away the sentiment. Dr. McBride, in the forensically revealing text messages and messages we have seen, had been using the word dysfunctional about members of the executive since at least May 2020, and you heard a flavour of some of the quotes this morning. And you may think it may have been used on many occasions appropriately thereafter, including the hurtful and premeditated decision of senior Sinn Féin members of the executive to attend a large-scale funeral gathering at a time when people across Northern Ireland were being denied that basic and emotive right by executive decisions they had been at the heart of making. But, my lady, this decision was more than just distressing to those who lost loved ones or were unable to do the same during this pandemic. It was also a decision by those who attended Mr. Storey's funeral to prioritise their friendships or leadership roles within their political tradition at the expense of their leadership roles in relation to a large-scale public health emergency affecting all political traditions and affecting the whole community.
That's just some of the testimony. We're going to lay out lots of the testimony, lots of the audio throughout the course of this programme this morning. Our health correspondent, Mary Louise Connolly, with us today. And the fact that this is day one and there are many more days to come, how shocking is this going to get, people might ask. But there was a lot yesterday in itself, Mary Louise.
Yes, Stephen, only day one yesterday. We're now, of course, on day two. And during big events and at critical times, such as during the pandemic, you know, we sometimes say only to be a fly on the wall. Well, I think these documents, emails, WhatsApps give us that opportunity to hear what was said in what were the worst of times and obviously very acrimonious meetings when it should be said pressure, tension was at tipping point. They are key moments in time, clearly, and I expect we will hear later today that there were times when the executive and the political parties did work together. But as you say, yesterday, day one, there were several jaw-dropping moments when we heard evidence presented by Peter Wilcock, KC, who was opening for the Northern Ireland bereaved families, when there were gasps around the media room, at least when we heard some of the detail of those WhatsApp messages between very important key players during the pandemic.
Can you lay some of those out to us? Obviously, we've signalled there what Michael McBride said. Are there others?
Yeah, well, let's take Sir David Stirling, who was head of the civil service at that time. And he wrote to the health minister on various occasions. We heard other WhatsApp messages where he describes point scoring, that politicians are more keen on scoring points off each other than helping the public. He said ministers had been too quick to retreat into camp or community activist mode. And when they did have to make difficult decisions, said David Stirling, such as school closures and those defining times whenever really, you know, hours, days matters, he said they had been found wanting. Not a great picture, Stephen. And we can't forget, obviously, very, very difficult for the families yesterday who were hearing people that we are household names in Northern Ireland, people like David Stirling, like Sir Michael McBride, Robin Swan. We're getting a real insight how difficult it was at times to make those decisions that affected what happened in care homes and hospitals, how people were buried. And the tone here yesterday, or the feeling here yesterday, I'm standing in the foyer of the Clayton Hotel, both inside and outside among families. I think they had a good idea what was coming, but to hear it read out in evidence and to hear language that you have played in your programme this morning, I think it really brings home the tension that existed between the parties at a really important time in Northern Ireland's history.
And the reason why we need to make sure that the public are across all of this, and we appreciate your reporting, that of our colleagues in the BBC newsroom, what we're doing here on this programme, is because this is not just about the past. And the past is a very important issue to those people who have lost their loved ones in the past. There is another issue running alongside this. Many of these people who behaved like this are currently in government, are still in politics in Northern Ireland, and will be making the next decisions.
Well, Stephen, I think the pandemic was a time like no other. We recall those times where, you know, we're hearing words yesterday where asked Tim, we've either chose to forget, we lived in bubbles. There was the R number, do you remember that, where we used to tune in to see which areas in Northern Ireland were affected by the R number. I think the pandemic was a really different time, and lessons have been learned. I did speak to a number of politicians last night and people that we've been talking about, and they are keen to say that at those times that are being brought to the fore during the pandemic, they were key moments. And I'm aware that as the days and weeks go on, we will hear more positive exchanges that did occur. But certainly what we heard yesterday on day one were what we called mic dropping moments, when really we were that fly in the wall. We could see what had been said and how acrimonious it was during meetings, and how the Robin Swan has said he felt very much alone at times. He was the only minister within the Ulster Unionist Party, and he felt he was fighting a fight at times and trying to get decisions made. And all of that, of course, backed up in these WhatsApps from David Stirling and from Sir Michael McBride, the Chief Medical Officer. And these are important, Stephen, because what the barristers laid out yesterday, these were during pivotal times from January to March, when clearly we know Northern Ireland was not very well prepared for a pandemic. The civil contingency service was understaffed. They were instead being moved to prepare for a no-deal Brexit, and the mind and the eye was off the ball.
My Louise, thank you very much indeed. Remember, one of the most senior man in the civil service, David Stirling, he's giving testimony to the COVID inquiry today. In an exchange, he texted the following: in a crisis, they seem keener on scoring points off each other than helping this citizen. Now, if he is right, and it's for you to determine and feed into this programme today, 03030 80 55 55, when people were dying, David Stirling believes that our politicians were keener scoring points off each other than helping the citizen. One of those citizens was the father of Katrina Miles. Good morning, Katrina.
Good morning.
Your dad died during COVID.
He did.
When you hear the head of the civil service, the former head of the civil service, David Stirling, when you hear our chief medical officer, Michael McBride, Stirling, Mr. Stirling, I've quoted him, Michael McBride, described them as dysfunctional bees. What's your reaction?
The citizens of Northern Ireland and my daddy, we didn't need party political point scoring. We needed an effective executive following good scientific evidence. And the families left bereft by COVID grief, by COVID loss, we just hope that the next 3 weeks will uncover some of the unanswered questions, some of the what ifs that keep us awake at night. What went right, what went wrong, and what needs to be changed for the future.
Were you surprised?
Sadly, not. We were pretty well prepared for what we were going to hear, as well as you can be. But when it's laid out in front of you, you can't help but feel you're in some sort of a movie. Never 4 years ago did we think that we would be involved in a public inquiry into the biggest public health crisis in living history. And 2 years ago, we didn't even know if we would get to look at what went on within Northern Ireland specifically. Because we're governed so differently, our health and social care system is so different. And whilst we appreciate that the inquiry has come to Northern Ireland, we don't feel that 3 weeks will be long enough to disseminate what happened here and why it happened.
What are the key questions for you that you want answered, Katrina?
I suppose for us, what was the impact of starting off the pandemic on the back foot, having had a political vacuum for 3 years, having had a new executive in its infancy, having had the party politics that we have here on this small piece of land? You know, how much of that fed into the detrimental effect of the massive loss we had in Northern Ireland. I mean, over 5,000 families sitting today feeling exactly as I do. I think, you know, we could say at this point already, we know that we were in the back foot, but we will dig into that deeper and see just how much that fed into what actually played out in Northern Ireland.
The Minister, Naomi Long, has given us an interview this morning. We're going to hear from the Minister later in the programme. She says the executive owe Northern Ireland an apology for the dysfunctionality that there definitely was.
Yeah, I mean, at what point do we stop using this term, dysfunctional governance? You know, it's not carte blanche for any ill treatment for the citizens of Northern Ireland. I mean, my daddy and 5,000 others paid the ultimate sacrifice for their dysfunctionality.
They were under a lot of pressure. They were dealing with an unprecedented situation. They would argue they were doing their best.
Well, we're at Module 2C, and we've already uncovered that the UK were well aware there was going to be a pandemic. Now, they might not have known what type of pandemic, but we've already found out that lots of resources were used and sent over to preparing for a no-deal Brexit. You know, there was a report sitting on a shelf for years. Lots, very little legislation for us for civil contingencies, unlike over the water. All we had was recommendations, which now leaves us in a position that there's plenty of wriggle room for everyone. You know, just because something's a recommendation, there's no legislation to say that that has to be enacted. And that has to change, and that has to change urgently, because it's not about if another pandemic hits. The scientific community have told us that it's when it hits.
Katrina, thank you for coming on this morning. Let's hear some from Counsel to the Inquiry, Claire Dobbin, KC. And part of her contribution yesterday was when she talked about one of the key meetings when Michelle O'Neill was explaining to the executive after she had attended the funeral of her friend Bobby Storey. The executive office is now telling you, the civil service is now telling you, the public of Northern Ireland, that they have lost the notes of that meeting.
On the 30th of June 2020, the Deputy First Minister and the Minister for the Department of Finance attended a funeral of a Mr. Storey. We understand that the executive of the TEO hasn't been able to find the notes of the executive committee meeting that took place after that.
What's the smell test around this to you? Maybe you can pick up the phone to us, 03030 80 55 55. What's the smell test around a meeting like that and the notes happen to get lost? Is anybody going to look into how they got lost? Who lost them? How many times do notes get lost? Is that a regular occurrence? Or did it just so happen that they were lost after this meeting? I think we would all like to know the answers to that. The Belfast Telegraph's Sam McBride has been looking extensively into this whole story. Good morning to you, Sam.
Good morning, Stephen.
This was, look, to anybody's barometer, this is astonishing what we heard on day one yesterday.
Yes, it is, Stephen, but it's also entirely predictable. I had a sense of deja vu yesterday. This feels like the RHI inquiry all over again. The same sort of behaviour, obviously in circumstances where people are dying rather than money being wasted, but the principal problem completely unchanged. We've heard from Jane Brady, the head of the civil service. We've heard from ministers. We've heard from all sorts of people. They fixed things. They changed things. Lessons were learnt. All of the platitudes, all of the cliches. And here we have a situation where right up until the present day, until very, very recently, after the pandemic, phones are being wiped. There is clear evidence that, things which were told to the Stormont Civil Service ought to be retained, repeatedly were told they ought to be retained, they're being deleted. What really, fundamentally, has changed in Stormont since RHI?
Jim Allister will be on the programme later. He is saying that after this inquiry, it's due to last 3 weeks, that he thinks there should be consideration as to whether the PSNI should be investigating how notes were lost, how information was wiped.
Well, I think that that's a very reasonable stance, if for no other reason than to try to reassure the public that this wasn't what it looks like it might have been, a quite deliberate attempt to pervert the course of this public inquiry, trying to get to the truth. They may well say, and we will hear their evidence over coming weeks, that this was a complete cock-up, that there was no ulterior motive to this. But after so much evidence over recent years of how the civil service has operated, how the storm system has operated, it just so happens that they've lost the notes of the key executive meeting after the Bobby Storey funeral. It just so happens that the First and Deputy First Minister's phones were wiped after multiple instructions from the Cabinet Office, from the inquiry, really laying it on thick, do not destroy this. Do not delete this, and they are deleted. And then after that, Stephen, I think the most alarming piece of evidence yesterday at the inquiry was that after they wipe these phones, they realise there's a problem. They realise that they're going to have to explain this to the public inquiry. This was early last year, May last year, almost a year ago now. There is a big meeting at Stormont. Senior officials discuss this. There's a lawyer in the room. The person who was the lawyer whose name we don't yet know, but we're told that the inquiry yesterday, they dispute that meeting was told that the phones had been wiped, but there was a minute of that meeting which said the phones have been wiped and we need to tell the inquiry. And what did they do? They redrafted that minute 13 times. And at the end of that process, it did not say clearly what it said at the start. Now, if this was a genuine mistake, if some junior official somehow has the power in the Stormont Civil Service to take the First Minister's phone and wipe it when there's been a clear instruction not to do that, if that was that level of incompetence, why would they not simply say that to the inquiry at the earliest possible opportunity? Instead, you have this very convoluted process where even after that meeting in May, they meet the inquiry, I think it was two times, in a very informal setting. People from the inquiry, lawyers, fly to Belfast, meet with senior civil servants in the Stormont Executive Office, and they talk about what's coming up. And at no point do they tell those people what has happened. I mean, that really stinks.
It's about how is this country being run? It's about the people, the plumbers, the hairdressers, the office workers who are paying their taxes in this country, who are trying to rely on both the civil service and ultimately the politicians who instruct them to improve their lives, the lives of their children. Are these people acting with integrity? Is the question the working people and the other citizens of this country will be asking this morning. Is there integrity in the civil service? Now, broad brushstrokes are unacceptable. There's a lot of integrity. There's a lot of hardworking people. But how do these things, how do these coincidences happen? How do notes get lost just about that massive meeting, as you pointed out? And this is addressed in terms of the WhatsApp messages that were then deleted. Let's have a listen, Sam, to Counsel to the Inquiry, Claire Dobbin-Casey.
This inquiry, quite early on, sought the preservation of WhatsApps. So, first of all, in June 2021, when the Prime Minister confirmed that there would be a statutory inquiry, a Director General in the Cabinet Office, Mr Tierney, wrote to all permanent secretaries responsible for each devolved administration, asking them to take steps to ensure that they'd be ready to meet their obligations when the inquiry was set up. And departments were asked to ensure that no material of potential relevance to the inquiry was destroyed. Baroness Foster resigned on the 14th of June 2021. We understand that she returned her Northern Ireland Civil Service issued mobile phone but kept her iPad, but eventually both were reset by the Northern Ireland Civil Service IT department. I'll refer to that as IT Assist, which had the effect of deleting all of the data stored on them. I think she suggests, and we will ask her about this, that in any event she periodically deleted WhatsApp messages when she was First Minister, and upon leaving office deleted any remaining messages. Later, on the 16th of September 2021, Miss Jane Brady, who was by then Head of Civil Service, wrote to all permanent secretaries setting out the documentation that might be relevant to the inquiry. And this included guidance that it would include electronic documents, including text messages and WhatsApps. And then subsequent to this, in January 2022, Mr. Connor, who's secretary to this inquiry, wrote to Mr. Tierney, again asking that the message about retention be reiterated across the departments. And again, Mr. Connor drew attention to material as including emails, texts, WhatsApp and other communications. And again, Mr. Tierney wrote to all permanent secretaries, including in devolved administrations, reiterating that message. So then when it came to Module 2C in September 2022, it sent a Rule 9 request to TEO asking to be provided with information concerning the extent to which there was informal communication. And requests were made to the Department of Health and the Public Health Agency and the CMO in this regard. So in relation to the TEO, Module 2C sought at an early stage to understand whether and to what extent informal channels of communication had been used in Northern Ireland in terms of the government response. And we sought that at an early stage as a foundation for further Rule 9 requests so that they could be sent on a more informed basis. It now appears that in May 2023, a senior civil servant, the Director of COVID Strategy within the TEO, was made aware that there might be a problem with the wiping of ministerial phones. And we understand that on the 9th of May, one of her team emailed the principal private secretaries to the First Minister and the Deputy First Minister, noting her understanding that their and their special advisors' devices had been reset, and requesting confirmation as to who had provided the instructions to do so. The questions included who had instructed and completed the stripping of these devices, did ministers and advisers return iPads and phones reset? And the email noted, we'll need to inform the UK COVID inquiry team of the status of these if wiped and why that exercise was carried out. And I think the position reached in terms of the Deputy First Minister's office is that it was confirmed that their devices had been reset, but that they had been returned to their offices reset. And the First Minister's office explained that they had been returned some time ago and reset, as I've said, IT Assist. Slightly different in respect of the Health Minister, Mr. Swan. We understand that, in fact, the Department of Health kept his laptop and that it was held in a secure cabinet in case it was needed for any inquiries. So, in other words, the message did appear to at least have gotten through to his office that his devices ought to be kept.
Sam?
Well, I think that lays out very clearly what happened here, just how this went on and on and on. We're not talking about one junior official one day making one mistake. We're talking about a litany of errors, if that's what they are. And based on what we know, I mean, how is it that we're not aware at this point of anybody being disciplined for this, of this having been escalated to a very, very major level? Obviously, we will hear evidence about this. We've got Jane Brady, who's now head of the civil service, up in front of the inquiry on Friday. She will be questioned about this. That's what was said yesterday very clearly. But I mean, how is it that the minutes of this meeting, for instance, where there is a clear record at the start of what happened and they're altered to conceal that fact, how is that in the public interest? I mean, it was said said by Claire Dobbin Casey yesterday that this was a deliberate decision taken by the director of COVID strategy. This is a very senior civil servant who is deciding to alter the minutes of a meeting. And if you think, Stephen,
well,
minutes
of meetings can be tracked, and you can have an initial version and then the final version of what is being recorded. That's pretty standard procedure that you're drafting and drafting and drafting.
Of course. So if you're altering the minutes of a meeting to clarify what was said, of course there's no issue with that. If somebody has made a mistake and that's being changed, there's no issue with that. First of all, we're only getting to see that these minutes have been altered because an inquiry is looking at this forensically. If you were to stick in an FOI request and ask for the minutes, you would get the minutes. You would not get all of those versions unless you knew that they existed. You specifically asked for them. So first of all, it's very significant that in most occasions you would not even know that this lay behind what was on the page in front of you. But secondly, that's not what happened here. These minutes are not being clarified to add to them. They're being clarified in a way that removes information. And how is there any possible argument that is in the public interest? I mean, it's just extraordinary that happens in the Stormont Civil Service, that nobody seems to bat an eyelid, nobody seems to get disciplined, and things just roll on and on.
And we've heard part of the Peter Wilcock KC, his contribution when he referred to Sinn Féin's behaviour around the Bobby Storey funeral. He also referred to the DUP blaming nationalists for spreading the virus more than others.
That's right. And I mean, he was very critical of what I think it was Edwin Poots had said about that particular issue. He was also very critical of how the wider DUP, if you like, at the Stormont Executive deployed their veto. So their veto, which was meant to protect the interests of unionists or nationalists, in law, they didn't break any law. There was nothing written into the law that said you couldn't use it for any reason. But you had a situation where the health minister, another unionist, was proposing to lengthen COVID restrictions. And because there was a big political dispute about this, because that was not something which people in the DUP were in full agreement with, they decided to press this nuclear button. Now, Dr. Andrew McCormick, who was a very senior civil servant at the time, who was in some of these executive meetings, he said that was really incongruous. It didn't really seem right. He made clear it wasn't breaking any laws, but it was using something that was meant to be there to protect one side of the community against the other in a way that was inappropriate in practice, if you like, if not in the letter of the law.
I mentioned Mr. Wilcock. Let's hear what he said about the DUP.
There were many examples of political dysfunction in the political response to the pandemic. In this context, you will hear evidence of outrageous and scientifically baseless assertions by senior politicians, senior ministers, that there was a meaningful difference in transmission between nationalist and unionist areas.
Sam, thank you very much indeed for your analysis so far. I've no doubt we will be back to you over the coming days and weeks. I've been speaking to the Justice Minister, Naomi Long, this morning, and I asked Naomi for her reaction to our Chief Medical Officer, Professor Sir Michael McBride, referring to some ministers within the executive as dysfunctional bees when describing their behaviour during COVID.
Well, look, I think, first of all, I recognise how tough this will be for families. This inquiry is important in terms of trying to find better ways to handle these really complex issues. And it's important that we get the opportunity to do that. I recognise that things will have been said in the heat of the moment in a tone and a manner that perhaps people were venting. Michael McBride was under extraordinary stress during this period too. And so from my perspective, I get it. We all vent at times, Stephen. We all get frustrated. And we express that as a way of getting it off our chest. And so, you know, I think some of this stuff is a bit salacious and, frankly, unhelpful.
But I'm not asking...
The fundamental issue is the executive dysfunctional? Well, look, we've already had this conversation. Alliance has brought forward proposals to try and make it more functional so that it can operate better. You know, Stephen, in fact, you were the person who interviewed me after one of the most difficult periods in the executive, where we had met over the period of a week and couldn't make decisions. And I told you that I wrestled with whether or not I wanted to remain a member of that executive.
Well, that's what Michael McBride is saying. I'm not. Look, his tone, many people, as you have said, he was under pressure. The more important question is not about how he said it. The more important question is, was he right? And he also said in his message to Robin Swan that he was considering walking away, given how dysfunctional it was.
Well, I mean, I recall saying to you, I think it was on maybe the Friday morning or the Monday after that really horrible week in November in 2020. And I said to you, when you said to me, you seriously considered leaving. And I said to you, nobody in their right mind, having experienced what we've just gone through in the last week, would not have considered it, at least considered it. So it does not surprise me that those who were given advice to the executive, that members of the executive, after what was an absolute low, would have considered their position. And, I mean, having reflected on it at the time, I made the decision to stay because I believed, rightly or wrongly, that I was having a positive impact and that for me to have left would have caused more harm. But, and I'm sure Michael McBride reached the same conclusion in terms of his own contribution.
There is finally, and it's interesting, you know, talking to you as a justice minister, and the whole point within justice, within the whole departments, is about evidence and notes and all of that. And just finally, I wonder what you think the public is to make of ministerial phones being wiped when they shouldn't have been, and the COVID inquiry yesterday says they need more answers around that. Now we learn that after Michelle O'Neill attended the Bobby Storey funeral, there was an executive meeting, and guess what? The notes of that meeting have been, quote, lost. Do you think the public will buy that?
Well, look, I can't comment on that because the minutes of the executive meetings aren't something that I was responsible for, and, you know, so I don't know what the circumstances. I wasn't aware that had been lost.
It's a smell test, though, isn't it? And it's about confidence. And
well, I understand about confidence. I think also people need to recognise that when we hand our IT back, it's handed to someone else. So it's not when we leave as ministers and hand over our IT, it doesn't sit in a museum. It's handed to another member of staff in terms of value for money. And so the practice at the time was that you wiped everything off your laptop, it went back to factory settings, and then that was passed on, because things like your emails, your decisions, your meetings that you had were all minuted and put onto the main civil service system. Yeah. And I think this only, I don't think we had anticipated the degree to which things like WhatsApp or text would become so central to
but the representatives.
Or we may have done things differently, Stephen.
The representatives from the COVID inquiry, their point is they wrote to the civil service, they told them on multiple occasions of the necessity for that information to be kept, and it wasn't.
And again, that's not something that I can really answer for, because that wouldn't have been my responsibility. I was simply doing, if you like, the normal custom and practice in terms of returning mine. And I mean, the guy has tried. I mean, even my own personal WhatsApp, I tried to recover them, because I'm now on the third phone since I left the department. What I have been able to establish, which I hope will be helpful to the inquiry, is the names of the WhatsApp groups that I was in at that time. And I hope that will help reassure them that the things that I was doing on WhatsApp were not kind of get business around COVID or back channels, that what I was doing was all very clearly and distinct, because I don't believe in using WhatsApp for business. I just don't think it's an appropriate mechanism. I committed my decisions and all that record to email. And when I met with people, I did so with an official in the room to take notes. And that's just the good practice, and that's what I did. So I'm not sure my WhatsApps would have been much use, but at least I can show them what the names of the groups were, and hopefully that will provide some reassurance that that's accurate.
Final question. Does the executive owe the public an apology for the dysfunctionality that there was?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, I apologised at the time and I apologise now. I mean, I did everything within my power to try to get sensible, cohesive decisions so that we were able to try to steer a course through what was a completely both unexpected but also unprecedented crisis. It was one that took a toll on each of us, physically, mentally, and I think just in terms of our health and well-being generally. Our families were going through this along with everybody else, and it was not easy. And I recognise that many people suffered huge loss, and there are people still, as a result of COVID and as a result of decisions that were made, who are suffering today. And I don't take any of that lightly, Stephen. And if we could have done things better, you know, I wish that we had. We had very limited understanding of what this might look like at the time. And we had to act as we felt was in the best interest of people in Northern Ireland. But I'm certainly not going to sit here or stand in front of the COVID inquiry next week and say we did everything right. I mean, I think that would just be arrogant. We got things wrong.
Were decisions made on a sectarian business or a basis, or were decisions not made because of what community the political party was representing? That's one of the questions the inquiry's asking.
That will be a question. I mean, look, only those ministers who are in that situation can really. For me, I made my decisions based on the evidence in front of us. I made my decisions based on what I felt was in the best interest of the people of Northern Ireland. If I got it wrong, I will hold my hands up and take my stripes for that. But for me, it was never about who brought the proposal or who supported or opposed it. For me, it was solely about what I believe was in the best interest of the people I was representing. And I believe it's a duty on every minister to be able to put their hand on their heart and say that next week.
Minister, thank you very much indeed. Thank you. We'll hear more from Naomi Long on a different subject later on the show. Columnist and former Ulster Unionist Party comms director Alex Keane's with us. Morning, Alex.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. And the commentator Kevin Moore is with us. Good morning, Kevin.
Morning, Stephen. Morning,
Alex, counsel for the bereaved families, if we listen to even just what he said, he is arguing that there was a situation here in Northern Ireland that even when people were dying in front of us, political parties couldn't leave green and orange aside, that life and death situations were being made, decisions were being made based on which community was represented.
Well, I think, Stephen, the difficulty with all of this and the tragedy, and we've heard some awful stuff yesterday, and we will hear some awful stuff in the next few weeks as well, you know, on how this the pandemic impacted people personally. But, you know, through all of this, I think, and I remember writing about it at the time, just keeping notes of what was happening and so on, I said, when we come through this, what we'd be looking for, what I was hoping we would see, is maybe the politicians in Northern Ireland would realise here was a crisis which is not an orange and green crisis or a border crisis or a constitutional crisis. It was a crisis which affected every single person in the United Kingdom, indeed almost every single person in the world, and that maybe, just maybe, they would prove to themselves that they could pull together, they could work together. Yes, they would make, as Naomi Long said there, wrong decisions were made, some right decisions were made, but at the end of it, they would prove to themselves that they could, together, collectively, do things better.
They were applying the cross-community vote mechanism during COVID.
That's what I'm saying, Steve. If you like, almost the tragedy of all of this. And it's a thing that I think politicians, you know, some of them will think, they won't be so bad, you know, this is just the first few days, bad stuff. And so I think the lasting impression of this so far is just how many people in Northern Ireland, even those who don't really get hung up all that much on the executive and so on, how many people are now going to think they just couldn't govern? They were incapable of governing. They're used to hearing that on schools, on hospitals and other things. That I think the sheer shock is going to hit people fairly soon, Stephen, is the fact that the parties in Northern Ireland couldn't, even at a moment like that, a moment which has not existed in the lifetime of any of them, couldn't actually pull together and say, right, let's see if we can collectively do the best for everyone. But no, increasing evidence is that they couldn't do that. They couldn't even do that, Stephen.
Kevin, should they be ashamed of themselves?
I find myself feeling a little bit more charitable towards the politicians, I have to say, which might not be a desperately popular position. I don't think this is an orange and green issue, to be honest. I think all organisations, all governments were struggling to deal with a pandemic that they were just very ill-equipped to deal with. And it doesn't matter whether that's UK government or other governments around the world and all parts of the UK. Of course, some of the issues that have come to light here about how Northern Ireland responded are just as appropriate to how Scotland responded. It was trying to deviate as well from UK positions as well. Because, of course, we're trying to make these decisions in real time with very scant evidence and information.
Our chief medical officer talked about an enemy from within.
I thought that was a bit hyperbolic and a bit unfair, I have to say. I've been involved in these kinds of civil contingencies issues in my career in different roles elsewhere. And these things are led by officials. You know, there are people whose job it is to game out all these scenarios. It's not that, you know, and loop the politicians in accordingly. And I think this is a classic example where the politicians in Northern Ireland, but elsewhere as well, we're not brilliantly equipped for making these real-time decisions. And this is where the officials needed to step up. And it feels to me a little bit like the chief medical officer is passing the buck.
Can we look at the issue, the important issue, and the effect of public on public confidence of phones being wiped and notes being lost, Alex Kane? If the civil service can lose notes of a key meeting like that, is it the instinct of the public to wonder, well, if we're in a country where notes can go missing, there are clear instructions for phones not to be wiped, and yet they are, like, what's next? Will judges start losing notes? Will other key services in Northern Ireland, will our police start losing evidence? Like, where does this end?
Well, in terms of the notes being lost, the executive, the normal thing would be, Stephen, that even if all the ministers aren't at a meeting, even if everybody involved at every, you know, is no representative meeting, notes are circulated. This will remind aid memoirs just to let people know this: the meeting took place. These are the people here. These are the decisions made. It's actually quite difficult to lose notes in the cases like that unless someone has.
And yet, it happens here.
Yes,
about a key meeting.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. It's quite difficult to do it unless someone makes a decision. Because, as Naomi, any minister would tell you, you know, you have 13 or 14 floating about and their advisors and so on and other senior staff sitting in there. You know, people had to have their own records. They have official records, and yet this disappeared. In terms of the phone wiping, now, yes, I take the point that when ministers leave and so on, things go back. But I do know of cases, Stephen, where phones, the ministers can't sit down and with a chief advisor and go through the content. But this notion, I've been in jobs where, you know, you get the phone back, the phone, the computer belong. When I worked at the assembly, they belong to the assembly and so on. But I made sure that everything that was relevant to me, that I thought this might come up at some point, I might need this, I might need to keep the record, I would not have handed my phone over to anybody and say, oh, dude, you like wipe it clean, do what is necessary. Particularly, Stephen, when you're dealing with a crisis like a pandemic, where you want all of the evidence to prepare for the next time it happens.
Alex,
you have a template.
Alex and Kevin, thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Good morning. We're promising you that there will be extensive coverage of the COVID inquiry here on The Nolan Show as we continue to ask more questions. We'll be back to more coverage in a moment or two. The Justice Minister, Naomi Long, on this programme has said that the Northern Ireland Executive owes the public of Northern Ireland an apology because of its behaviour, because of its dysfunctionality. And she repeated her statement that she considered walking away, given the degree of dysfunctionality that there was around the decision-making in the executive at the time. You know that Sir Michael McBride has called some of those ministers dysfunctional bees. You know that David Stirling and the comments that he made around the priorities for these politicians when they were considering making decisions for citizens. There's another important story today, a significant moment for the UK Government's Legacy Act today, with an end to historical inquests and the transferring of Troubles-era cases to a new body. The Belfast Telegraph crime correspondent Alison Morris is with us today. It's a big moment, Alison.
It is. It's, I suppose it's been described as a sort of watershed moment for victims, you know, the sort of cliff edge in terms of the ICRIR, which obviously many of those victims and all of the political parties were opposed to that Legacy Act, given the manner, I suppose, in which it was pushed through Westminster without initial consultation with any of the main victims groups. So I think today is quite a tough day for some of them. You know, we do still have to wait and see what way this is all going to play out. We have to see if families do want to interact with the ICRIR. I know that some have made initial contact, but they would need you know, the support of families across the board, and so far we're not really seeing evidence of that. And then obviously there's what's going to happen in the long term, because we've heard that Labour have said that they're going to repeal parts of it, although when you dig down to that, I noticed that Hilary Benn had said he would repeal the amnesty part of it. That's already been repealed. The courts have already taken that part out of the legislation anyway, so that no longer is applicable. And, you know, criminal investigations at this stage, we know, and most people accept, are very unlikely. But I suppose the particularly cruel part of it is the actions of the Secretary of State in relation to the inquest over the past few weeks. So we know that the coroner and the Sean Brown inquest just said, I just can't carry on with this anymore. There's that much, you know, so much is being withheld from me on national security grounds, and so much information is redacted. This needs a public inquiry. The same thing was meant to happen with the Fox and McKierney inquest on Friday, but the Secretary of State has intervened, which is an unprecedented separation of powers, to stop that happening.
Just talk to me more about that, because I was reading about that. It is unprecedented, is it, for the Secretary of State to intervene in that way?
It is completely. The Secretary of State to be intervening in the duties of the coroner is completely unprecedented, and you can see how that is absolutely enraging a lot of victims' families, who many of them campaigned for, you know, 15, 20 years to even get those inquests in the first place. They were told that any inquest that was at an advanced stage prior to the deadline would be allowed to continue. But if they're being frustrated and the point with information isn't being handed over, you know, I know in the Fox and McKierney case, and then also in the Sean Brown inquest, files were being sent to the coroner with pages and pages of the information. The disclosure was just black. It was just blanked out. It had all been redacted. And, you know, the coroner was unable to, you know, conduct their statutory duties when so much information was being withheld and the picture couldn't be painted as to what had actually happened. So, you know, when people see things like that happening, and they would question the motivations of the British government and the Secretary of State in terms of that. I mean, there are legal challenges to that, but the Secretary of State has now said, you know, he will appeal some of those to the Supreme Court if necessary, which means that, you know, the commitments made during that Legacy Act when it was being pushed through, where they said, you know, any inquest in advance stage will be allowed to continue to their conclusion. It seems now that that was not the case, that those inquests are just going to be frustrated anyway, so they can't deliver their findings. That is one of the sort of more cruel aspects of it. You can see how that sort of information recovery aspect of the ICRIR could be really helpful to some people who have maybe give up and abandoned hope of judicial justice. We just want answers, you know, questions. But that can't take place in isolation without other mechanisms such as inquests being allowed to deliver their findings.
Alison, thank you very much. Alison Morris from the Belfast Telegraph. 9 minutes past 10, 030 30 80 55 55. Back to the COVID inquiry. Nuala Toman, the head of Innovation and Impact at Disability Action, was giving evidence to the inquiry yesterday. Good morning to you, Nuala.
Good morning, Stephen.
I think it's very important that we keep people and the human stories at the centre of this, and that's what you were doing yesterday as you were describing the feelings from disabled people.
Yes, Stephen, that's correct. And I think even before we discuss that, it's really important to share condolences to the families of people who lost their lives during COVID-19, many of whom were represented yesterday at the inquiry. We were very privileged to be able to provide evidence around the experiences of disabled people during the pandemic. And really, based on the evidence that we put forward, really shows how political dysfunction, the absence of cross-departmental working, the lack of an overall strategic, the terminology most like to be used is like a cabinet kind of response to the pandemic was absent in the region, and as a result of that, disabled people were forgotten, left behind, going hungry, isolated.
But how can you say that with surety that as a result of that lack of cohesion, disabled people, the COVID-19 itself was killing people, disabled and non-disabled, no matter what governments throughout the world did, no matter how functional they were? Is it fair to put that on this executive?
Well, from our perspective, we have submitted lengthy evidence proposals to the inquiry, both at Module 1, Module 2, across all of the other devolved nation inquiries and to Module 2C. So from our perspective, really, we have multiple examples whereby if there was better and stronger cross-departmental collaboration, that disabled people would have been better protected.
In what way? Give me examples.
For example, if we look at the food response, which was a very noble endeavour brought forward by the Department for Community, that response brought together organisations who were funded by the Department for Communities, and those that were then funded by the Department of Health were absent. So organisations like Disability Action and Children in Northern Ireland, for example, were not embedded in that emergency response. And the pipeline to identify disabled people wasn't there. And that meant that food parcels were only delivered to 6% of the Shielding list. And closer cooperation between the Department of Health and the Department of Communities would have enabled that. And we have case law, you know, when the Human Rights Commission took case law in respect of access to abortion, in which, you know, judges have concluded that there is a severe lack of cross-departmental collaboration here.
So what happened to those people, those disabled people who needed those food packages and never got them? What happened?
Well, they were left hungry and reliant on carers and family members to try and provide them with food in circumstances in which people were advised to isolate. And that left people in a very dangerous situation at a time at which health and social care had collapsed. So, you know, at that time, we conducted research in April 2020 that really showed that disabled people were isolated, alone, hungry, and without access to services.
Nuala, thanks for being on this morning. Thank you very much indeed. John's calling us from Dundonald. Morning, John.
Good morning, Stephen.
Go ahead.
It's just, I find it really laughable, or wasn't so serious, that they can't find the documents from the last executive meeting. Now, we've all been at meetings, yourself included. Do we forget everything that was said at that meeting as soon as we leave the door? So why don't they get everybody that was present at that meeting into a room and ask them all what they thought happened to that meeting. What was said?
Look, John, that's your opinion, and some people might agree with you, but there's a bigger issue than that. The bigger issue is, how does an official record suddenly go missing? How does that happen? And also, I wonder, should we have a look across all the executive meetings so that we all know how many records go missing? Was that the only record that went missing? Or were there many? Because it is key that the public either have confidence in our civil service, or it is key that the public get answers as to what happened. It is not good enough, is it, that we're left in the dark as to how does a record go missing? When did it go missing? Who was responsible for making sure it didn't go missing? What is the process for recording them? And is it a coincidence that the record that went missing was about that controversial executive meeting? That's what's on people's minds. Are you still there, John?
So,
yes, go ahead, John. Final comment to you. Oh, he's dropped off. Okay. His signal's gone. So he's not talking. I was wondering why there was silence. 0-30-30-80-55-55. another story this morning, the first in a series of three short films highlighting the harm being caused by paramilitaries in Northern Ireland, has been launched by the Northern Ireland Executive's Programme on Paramilitarism and Organised Crime. The film will provide an insight into how today's paramilitary gangs intimidate, control and coerce individuals and communities. Here's a little clip from one of the films.
As a community worker, I see people victimised by paramilitaries every single day. Entire communities being controlled, whether it's beatings, shootings, intimidation, extortion. It affects everyone. Most have grown up vulnerable in some way, surrounded by violence and abuse, and more often than not are just born into this fear. It's always there. It's all they've known, and the paramilitaries are not stupid. They know to look for these vulnerabilities and they know exactly how to exploit them.
Our Justice Minister, Naomi Long, has been speaking to The Nolan Show about these videos and why they're so important.
Well, Stephen, I think it's really important that we recognise the impact that paramilitarism continues to have in our community. These gangs are essentially the same as other organised crime groups, but they have that paramilitary past and they can exist in our society largely because they use that as a cloak of convenience. And what we have found is, in our research, that around 40% of people in Northern Ireland are affected by paramilitary harm. Over a third of organised crime groups have paramilitary links. And so it's important that we tackle this in society. And the videos are about highlighting some of the very insidious ways that paramilitaries control and exploit vulnerable people, particularly children. And how we can then try to support people who are in that position, tackle the paramilitaries themselves, and also create more resilient communities where they're not able to have that level of hold and control.
The data reveals that the average age to witness paramilitary violence in this country is 14 years of age. And within that age group, half have witnessed violence, a quarter have been threatened with violence, and 8% have been attacked. I find that astonishing. A quarter have been threatened with violence.
It's really disturbing. And one of the things we're looking at particularly is how we use the safeguarding that we use when we're routinely dealing with children at risk in this space where it is child criminal exploitation, or where it's physical abuse of children by these organised crime gangs. And so one of the things that we have been doing is working with our partners in the Department of Health, working with PSNI, with the Health Trust, Youth Justice Agency, Department of Education, to say, how do we apply a safeguarding approach to young vulnerable people, but also to older vulnerable people? Because paramilitaries are very good, and the first video actually shows this, paramilitaries are very good at identifying those vulnerabilities and leaning in on those vulnerabilities in order to coerce people into criminal activity or to put pressure on them to behave in ways that they wouldn't otherwise behave in.
But how can we deal with this? Because, you know, the reality of the street is that if these young people go to the authorities, they will run the risk of being beaten up, kneecapped, burnt, their homes burnt out, their parents attacked. That's how these paramilitary groups survive, on intimidation, basically. So how do we expect a young person to come forward and say they're being exploited?
Well, first of all, we recognise that it requires courage to do that, but we also have had success where people have come forward, because it allows us, first of all, to be able to establish patterns of behaviour. That can be very useful to the PSNI in terms of being able to pursue the perpetrators of this abuse. It also allows us to provide additional support to those young people so that they are no longer as vulnerable to that exploitation as they might otherwise be. And we're actually having some really good results, Stephen. And I mean, we often talk about the negatives, but we're having good results through educational support for young people. We have a community transformation programme for women. Probation Board are doing some excellent work with vulnerable young men. There are initiatives around to speed up justice, programmes supporting communities, so that we're making it harder for paramilitaries to be able to do these things and also provide more protection to those who might be vulnerable. And it has to be a coordinated effort. It's not just about justice. We've got to have health, education, the community and voluntary sector all working in the same space to provide that support.
Can we talk about the elephant in the room here, which is the authorities know, journalists know, members of the public know who the leaders of these paramilitary organizations are. People in the local communities watch those leaders continue to benefit from their crimes, continue to be free despite exploiting and intimidating the community. Why don't we take them out and put them in jail?
Well, there's a difference between knowing and proving. And that's the challenge that the PSNI, Public Prosecution Service, and the courts face in dealing with this. So you may well know or suspect that somebody is behaving in a certain way, but you have to prove that beyond reasonable doubt in the courtroom, and that requires evidence. And as you rightly said, the fear that people feel in communities about coming forward, about sharing intelligence and information that they might have, it actually makes it harder for the police. So there is a challenge there. The police work very hard to disrupt their activities, because by disrupting, people then make mistakes, and that's when people get caught. So that's an important part of the strategy. But the other side of it, Stephen, is that there will be people, in terms of, you've mentioned, benefiting from their crimes. We have introduced elements of the Criminal Finances Act, which would allow, for example, the seizure of assets, the freezing of bank accounts. And those are two unexplained wealth orders, for example, that allow the police to actually investigate forensically somebody's finances. And those are tools that we have provided to help the police deal with the economic impact of that crime.
It's interesting the timing of this interview, because here we are talking about the job that the police has to do and our expectation of what the PSNI has to do. To be fair to you, you've been talking about other government departments as well and the joined-up approach. I get that. But in terms of the police, you face a decision that we'll all be interested in. You've got your budget into the Department of Justice now, and it's not enough. You've made that clear. And you're going to have to decide within that pot of money how much you give to prisons and how much you give to the police and other areas. Are you going to give the police the money they need? Are prisons coming first? Or how are you going to make that decision?
Well, it's not about what comes first, Stephen. It's about ensuring that every part of the justice system functions. Because if we fund the police to the exclusion of everything else, that won't work. If we fund prisons to the exclusion of everything else, that won't work.
Is the Chief Constable likely to be disappointed?
Well, I mean, I'm disappointed in the settlement that I got. We bid for £444 million and got £95 million. So you can see the challenge that we have, and those are inescapable pressures. In fact, the only pressure that I would argue isn't inescapable, but certainly was essential, was an £8 million bid for recruitment for the PSNI. So, I mean, everything else in that we can't control, and that's going to be challenging. So I would be surprised if everyone in the justice system isn't disappointed at the allocations. But what we need to do is ensure that we, as best we can within the resource we have available, fund each part of the justice system in a way that allows the entire system to continue to function.
When's the Chief Constable going to find out?
Well, the Chief Constable will be coming in to meet me actually today. We're having a session with his finance people and mine. And the chair and vice chair of the policing board. And we're going to sit down and have this conversation with them about the challenges we face as a department and the challenges that the PSNI specifically face and how we can try to meet that. Because look, I want to work with the Chief Constable. We all want effective policing. But part of having an effective justice system is having a court system that can respond if somebody's arrested, a prison system that can accommodate people when they're committed to prison, and a probation service that can monitor people adequately in the community, and so on and so on. So we can't simply talk about policing in isolation. It has to be a whole system approach.
But given the amount of money that you have now received in the budget, 95 million compared to nearly 400 million that you say you needed. Is it safe to say that the PSNI in Northern Ireland are going to be significantly underfunded? And that's the message that Boucher's going to get today from you.
Well, the justice system as a whole, Stephen, has been underfunded for most of the last 15 years. I mean, it's been recognised that we've been underfunded, not just from myself raising this over the period when I've been in office, but actually the Fiscal Council recognised that the justice system, in comparison to other departments, was underfunded. Northern Ireland as a whole is underfunded, so we have to factor that in too. But justice has been particularly negatively affected. So in the last 15 years, for example, since the devolution of justice, we've seen health increase their budget by 68%, education by over 40%, and justice by 3%. So, I mean, there's no question that justice is underfunded. What we need to do is look at how we can use the meagre resource we have to best effect, and that's the conversation that I need to have with all of the people in the justice system so that we're able to continue to provide a level of service, a level of public protection that we can within resource. And if you don't invest in a service, Stephen, that service won't be there. I mean, we've got to pay people to do a job, and most of the justice system is very reliant on human resources. You can't run prisons and policing and courts without people.
That's the Justice Minister, Naomi Long. We could have done 24 hours today on the programme. Given the amount of news there is, the amount of feedback we're getting from you. So we only have 90 minutes in the morning, but we're here every day and we'll be back to this in the morning. Laird's in Ballymena. Morning, Laird.
Good morning, Stephen. How are you?
Very quickly for me.
Okay. One of the biggest things I believe with COVID when it was actually declared for the shutdown and stuff was a complete loss of confidence in what the government was actually saying 2 weeks in. And there were many demonstrations of that, and it got worse. And once you actually lose the confidence of what's actually been said, then it's really hard to stay online.
Okay. Laird, listen, thank you very much. Thank you for your call today. Listen, as we come to the end of another Nolan Show, we reaffirm our commitment to bring you extensive coverage of the COVID inquiry over the next few weeks. And there is no doubt that many civil servants, that many officials, that many politicians work day and night trying to do their best, trying to save as many lives as possible with what was an unprecedented situation and very, very difficult dilemmas and decision making. But we have big questions on your behalf, and we promise you that we will fight to get you answers. As people were gasping their last breaths, was the decision-making being made with integrity in the heart of our government? Or did that dirty word sectarianism, did that exist in some political decision-making? When people died alone, when daughters and sons to this day are haunted because they missed the funerals of their mothers and fathers, we are to believe that keynotes around a key executive meeting have gone missing. To the Northern Ireland Civil Service, we want to know, on behalf of the citizens who listen to this programme, how does documents go missing? Who lost them? How does the truth around WhatsApp messages get wiped when you were told to protect it? And we ain't going away. We'll continue asking those questions. We'll see you in the morning.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.